In a world in which movies struggle to find plot, Alan Adams of The Main Edge breaks it down for you in Pass the Popcorn. Now on Downtown with Rich Kimball.
Let's all go to the lobby.
Yeah, well, that music means it's time to visit the movies, courtesy of Alan Adams. And Alan has seen four movies this week.
That's right. We've got four to talk about this week. We've got, and they kind of run the gamut. We've got the big broad releases, stuff like Ghostbusters Afterlife and King Richard. We've also got a wonderful musical adaptation on Netflix, Tick, Tick, Boom. And a sort of a wild card, a VOD offering, starring friend of the show, Bruce Campbell, a little horror comedy called Black Friday.
Well, it should be a horror comedy. It's called Black Friday. But where do you want to start, my friend?
We'll start right there. So Black Friday, this was actually an unsolicited request for a review. I sift through a lot of these over the course of a week. But when you tell me that Bruce Campbell is in a movie that it revolves around a crew of retail workers at a big box toy store fighting off an alien invasion, I'm like, all right, you got me. Let's see how this is gonna go. And it's exactly as advertised. It's precisely what you think it is. It stars Bruce Campbell. It also stars Devon Sawa. Michael Jai White is in this movie as well. And basically, you've got this guy, Ken, played by Devon Sawa, who's been working at this big box toy store. It's called for about a decade. And he's divorced. He's got two kids. And basically is the sort of guy, you know, divorced with two kids, who is working retail at a toy store. So he has this crew of like, you know, misfits and oddballs. There's the cashier he's got a crush on. There's the germaphobe kid who's probably been here a little longer than he needs to be. I mentioned Michael Jai White, the mysterious sort of tough guy of the bunch. They're preparing for Black Friday under the auspices of their manager, Jonathan, played by Bruce Campbell. But strange glowing meteors are falling from the sky, Bruce, and they're crashing into these various retail outlets, pulsing pink things, and they're turning all the shoppers into ravenous sort of zombie monster things. And so you've got this crew trapped in this toy store trying to figure out a way to save the day. And that's pretty much it. It's a very, very brief, breezy kind of movie. It runs probably 80-ish minutes. It's a quick one. I enjoyed it very much. It's funny, very built around the sort of practical effects that you remember from sort of the lower rent horror movies of your youth, sort of that 80s, 90s vibe, in a way that is very, very visceral, like a lot of blood spatter, a lot of body parts, but it's so ludicrous and so over the top that it's just... it's just funny to watch. And then there are moments where they splice in some really questionable CGI as well. So you've got these weirdos basically trying to fight off an alien invasion while also dealing with all the sort of personal stuff that kind of bubbles up in the process. So, look, it's not a movie that, put it this way, we're not going to be hearing about this movie at Oscar time. But it's a lot of fun. As low rent 80s throwback, consumer culture commentaries go, it's not bad.
I'm glad you thought that my youth was in the 70s and 80s and not the 50s and 60s horror movies. What's up next?
Let's talk about Tick, Tick, Boom. It's on Netflix. It's adapted from the sort of one man musical written by Jonathan Larson, who's best known for the musical Rent. It marks the feature film directorial debut of Lin-Manuel Miranda. I was kind of surprised to hear that. I sort of assumed that he had made a movie by now, but this is his first go. And look, here's the thing. I went to college in the mid 90s and I studied theater. I am very familiar with Jonathan Larson's work. Like, it was just like, you know, it was just everywhere. You know, myself, my friends, like that work was very impactful to us at that time. Now, Tick, Tick, Boom is an earlier work revolving around sort of semi-autobiographical, where Jonathan Larson sort of plays himself. But in this movie, Jonathan Larson is played by Andrew Garfield, who I got to say is wonderful in this movie. And it's really a very simple story where it's the story of, you know, the time leading up to his 30th birthday. He's living in a cruddy walk up in New York City. He's been working on his sci-fi concept musical called Superbia for like 8 years. He's finally getting a workshop reading at Playwrights Horizons. And he's sort of put all his eggs in that particular basket. And meanwhile, on the periphery, his roommate has moved on from his theatrical dreams and gotten a legit job in marketing. His girlfriend, a dancer, is looking to take a teaching job in the Berkshires, so she'd be moving out of the city. And all the while, all he can think about is this piece of work that he's devoted, you know, almost half his life to at this point. And so we watch as he goes through the trials and tribulations of trying to make the workshop happen, trying to, bring in the sorts of power players who could potentially, you know, make his career by, you know, writing a check for this musical. A cast of characters that includes, among other people, Stephen Sondheim, who was apparently a real life mentor to Jonathan Larson, played here wonderfully by Bradley Whitford. And that's kind of it. Like, it's a very slice of life kind of story. It uses the actual performance of the show as kind of a framing device. So we have those moments where he's on stage and singing with his band and the backup singers and all that stuff. And then we have the actual narrative scenic work that's happening, telling the story of the film. It's like, I loved it. I legitimately loved it. Like, it was one of those things. The music is fantastic. Like, I've always been a big fan of Larson's musical theater work. He's got enough of that sort of rock edge to it to sort of, appeal to me beyond. I've never been a fan of the stodgier musical theater offerings, but this one really cooks in a lot of places. I think it benefits greatly from the fact that the story is being directed by someone who very much relates to that entire process, because Lin-Manuel Miranda did the same thing, like devoted so much of his early life to developing In the Heights and bringing that to fruition. And that led to so many more great successes for him. And it's an interesting parallel because, you know, Jonathan Larson was kind of on that trajectory 20 years earlier. You know what I mean? And for those who are unaware, Larson passed suddenly and tragically an aortic aneurysm. He was in his mid-30s, and it was just as Rent was opening on Broadway. So he never really got to see the full breadth of that project's success, which is, it's heartbreaking. It's one of the great losses, I think, of musical theater in the latter half of the 20th century. But this story does justice to him. Specifically, Andrew Garfield's great. Like, he's someone who, I've always, sort of recognized him as talented, but, I've never really gotten a sense of the sorts of projects he actually wants to do. And so his choices seem a little haphazard. But this, if he's not a musical theater guy, hats off to him, but, this reads like someone really embracing work that he has a personal connection to. And it was the music is banging, the cast is great. There are some wonderful production numbers, including, and it's for the song Sunday, and it's set in the Moondance Diner, which is where Jonathan Larson worked while he was working on this musical. It literally everyone that you've seen, just dozens of prominent Broadway figures appear in this scene. We're talking about, folks that you recognize, like B.B. Newworth, and folks like that, but also like Joel Grey, is in that scene. You know, just these iconic Broadway figures. You know, Patti LuPone is in it. Bernadette Peters, like just all these incredible, like incredibly popular people from that sort of from that vein, and to bring them all together in celebration of this man's work in this one wonderfully. I hesitate to call it cornball because that has like negative connotations, but it's cornball in the absolute best way, like in just that sort of broad jazz hands Broadway kind of way, and it's just a perfect fit within the auspices of this movie. But again, it just boils down to the fact that Andrew Garfield beautifully embodies Jonathan Larson both in performance, you know, on both in stage performance and in the context of the film's narrative. If you have any connection to the music of Jonathan Larson, to Broadway music in general, I think you should really check this one out. It's on Netflix right now, and it's well worth your time.
So you got two more.
We do. Let's talk about Ghostbusters Afterlife. Revisiting the things that we love is tricky. Like, how do you continue the stories that we cherish while also, you know, staying loyal to the original, but also adding something meaningful to the equation? Like, it's a very delicate sort of tightrope walk. And we see a lot of very talented people tip over to one side or the other. Like, it happens a lot. And to strike that balance is really, really difficult. So that's a long-winded way of saying that I approached Ghostbusters Afterlife with a little trepidation. I was because I love the Ghostbusters. Like I love the 84 original. I love the sequel from 1989. Like I'm even one of the small minority of people who enjoyed Paul Feig's reboot in 2016. Like I love this world and I love this franchise. And so the idea of making a direct sequel to those movies from 30 plus years ago, like it's like, is it ambitious? Is it risky? It's definitely complicated, particularly when you incorporate the fact that the director of the film, Jason Reitman, is the son of Ivan Reitman, who directed the original film. And, you know, there's going to be plenty of people talking nepotism and all that stuff. And I hear you, but the reality is, I think there are probably very few filmmakers out there in Hollywood as invested in the continued success of this franchise as Jason Reitman, because he grew up on that set. Like, you know, he was there watching his dad do this. And so maintaining that connection, I think, is really important. And I think he does it. Like, he does a really good job. Like, the third act gets maybe a little too fan service-y. You know, I could certainly see that argument being made. I didn't have a problem with it, but, you know, I could see if people did. But yeah, it's a really wonderful continuation of the story, an homage to what was so great about the originals, while also bringing something kind of new to the table. The storyline is, in a nutshell, we're in the town of Somerville, Oklahoma, small town out there. This is where Egon Spengler has gone following the events of Ghostbusters 2 back in 1989. He's retired to this dilapidated farm in the middle of nowhere because he is convinced that this is going to be the epicenter of the event that really brings about the end of the world. And so that's where he spends his time. And he's sort of the local eccentric, like hanging out there on the fringes. And the movie begins. We see him engaged in some sort of chase with a kind of unseen entity or what have you. And I don't think it's a spoiler because, you know, it happens within the first couple minutes of the movie. But he dies in that you know, in that confrontation, which introduces us to Callie, played by Carrie Coon, who is his estranged daughter. She's a single mom, lives in Chicago with her two kids, Trevor, played by Finn Wolfhard, and Phoebe, played by McKenna Grace. She's broke. They're getting evicted, and she gets this news that she's inherited everything from her dad that she hasn't spoken to in years. So they're off to Oklahoma. And that's where they go. They move in, they start cleaning out the house, and, you know, Trevor gets a job at the local drive-in restaurant because he sees a girl that he gets a crush on. And then Phoebe voluntarily enrolls in summer school, being taught by a completely disinterested science teacher / a seismologist named Mr. Gruberson, played by Paul Rudd, who's wonderful in this movie. Phoebe makes a connection with Mr. Gruberson. They start talking about the strange seismic activity here in Stillwater. As you might guess, there are some sinister underpinnings regarding the events surrounding that sort of seismic activity. And so Phoebe finds her way into her grandfather's things, his secret workshop, where she discovers, you know, ghost detectors and proton packs and the whole shebang. And she is guided to getting these things in working order. I'm not going to tell you how she's guided. You'll see when you see the movie. And meanwhile, Trevor goes out to the barn and finds under a tarp a rusted out Ecto-1 that he starts fixing up. And, look, ghosts are coming. Like, we know that the ghosts are coming. Like, I'm not going to, you know, I'm not spoiling anything. I will say the major menace from the first film is making a ferocious comeback. And I will add the people that you want to know if they're in this movie, they are in this movie. I'm not going to tell you anything more about that, but suffice it to say, your fandom will be serviced when you walk out of there. Look, it's a delight. Like, I had such a good time watching this movie. I was frankly stunned by how much fun I had. It was funny. It was lighthearted. Had a wonderful sort of familial vibe to it that you know, is different from the original movies, but still of a piece with it, I think. You know, we see these sort of intergenerational connections sort of blossoming, and we get to watch these kids sort of come of age and sort of thrust into situations that are maybe a little beyond them, but they're smart enough and they're capable enough, and, you know, I mean, they're Egon Spengler's grandkids. They're going to do all right.
Sounds good. And we've got just a couple of minutes left. What was the last of the four movies you saw? Man, you saw some serious amount of film.
Yeah. King Richard is the last one. It's currently in theaters, also streaming on HBO Max. It is the story of Richard Williams, the father of Venus and Serena Williams. And it's the title role is played by Will Smith, who is very much going for an Oscar. And just between you and me, I think he's got a real shot at it because he is excellent in this movie. The basic gist is, like, anyone listening to this show is almost certainly at least kind of familiar with the Williams sisters. You know who they are.
Yeah, we've talked about them a few times.
You know what I mean? But yeah, it's basically the story of Richard Williams as he tries to help his very young daughters sort of break into the tennis world. You know, these are Richard Williams and his wife Oracine have spent, you know, years coaching their daughters, Venus and Serena. Venus played by Sonia Sidney and Serena played by Demi Singleton, both of whom are excellent, as well as Oracine is played by Anjanou Ellis, and she's wonderful as well. But, you know, there's only so far untrained coaching can get them. And so they start. Richard has a plan, and he's going to feel out all these coaches and try to find a way to get these girls the coaching that he feels that they need. You know, it takes some time. You know, not everyone is on board with his plan. Eventually, he manages to get through to the legendary coach, Paul Cohen, played by Tony Goldwyn, to take on Venus, but Serena's not part of the package, so that causes some complications. And ultimately, they wind up working with the coach Rick Macchi and played by John Bernthal, who's outstanding in this movie, and making their move to Florida, and the film sort of the climactic moment of the film is sort of one of Venus's first professional matches when she takes on number one in the world at the time, Arantxa Sánchez Vicario, and we get to watch that that match play out and the ramifications that sort of spiral out, ripple out from the events of that match. This is a phenomenal movie. I love sports movies. I love biopics, and I love Will Smith. So I was always going to be in the bag for this one. But it really is an exceptional piece of work. We'll start with Will Smith, who very rarely does the sort of transformative performance. Like so much of what he does relies on his admittedly incredibly high amount of charisma. Like, he is a movie star, and you know that movie stardom I think sometimes gets in the way when he wants to really immerse himself in these roles, you know. And some folks never really worry about that. Like Tom Cruise is one who is perfectly happy to continue being Tom Cruise and everything he does. But Will Smith really goes for it in trying to turn himself into something other than Will Smith on your screen. And he's pretty successful. Like the idea that you can forget you're watching someone as famous as Will Smith is frankly like it's really impressive, and he really nails it. Like there are some moments where you get that sort of that charismatic twinkle, like you can't really like there's some light you can't fully hide under a bushel, and I think that's kind of him. But there are extended stretches where he is just absolutely crushing it, and he's the center of the frame. Like he is the sort of gravitational force around which all these other things are orbiting. That being said, the other performances also exceptional. Ingenue Ellis, who I was not familiar with her, but she is outstanding, and she's going to get a lot of attention. The two kids. Few things would torpedo a movie like this as quickly as poor performances from the child actors, and they are excellent. Goldwyn, Bernthal, they're all great. And it should be noted, the tennis is really good, because that's another thing that can really undermine your efforts when you're trying to make this kind of sports or even sports adjacent movie. If the sport itself doesn't look right when you're talking about two people who are, I mean, you could argue that they're certainly among the greatest tennis players ever. If you've got them out there and they don't look like they've ever held a racket before, like it's not going to work. But all that stuff is excellent. It's beautifully shot, beautifully framed, beautifully acted, compelling story. I genuinely believe that this just might be Will Smith's year. He's certainly going for it.
Well, I certainly hope so. I would argue Serena Williams is perhaps the best athlete in America this century.
Yep.
Alan, thank you so very much, my friend, and we will talk to you and see you again soon.
Yes, sir.